Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 470 featuring Hugo Guerra, who is a fantastic person. I have been wanting to talk to him for a long time. He is a director, visual effects supervisor, podcaster, YouTuber, live streamer, well known in that space. Actually, a lot of people know about his YouTube channels and the way what he talks about there. Obviously, he comes from a background of compositing, and a lot of stuff in that world that's very interesting as well. But we talk really about, you know, sort of him as and his career and responsibility of people that are you know, out there and talking about the industry, such as his channel and even this channel, and you know what people need to talk about. We talk about other channels as well, such as the Corridor Crew and subjects like the backlash against CG in the movie industry right now. And it's a pretty interesting subject in general. You know, talk a lot about AI and how that's changing the world of compositing and other tools and visual effects, and you know, other things that he does, such as Hugo's Live Desk, which is a live stream. Hugo's Desk, sorry, and which is really, really cool. So really great to talk to him. As you guys know, I haven't had an actual podcast out in a couple of weeks. I've been busy. We did a recap episode last time, so it's been a little bit hectic. But I just do want to let you guys know that I have been working very, very hard on Project Arena, and a lot of stuff is going on right now. So I am at on the other side of some of the projects we've been working on. So we'll be talking more about that as that comes out. But there is an article that came out in FX Guide. I highly recommend you guys go look at it on Project Arena so they can get some idea about what we're doing. So it's really very, very exciting project for me. It's actually, honestly, one of the most elaborate projects I've done in a very, very long time. So very excited about it. Anyway, a couple of product announcements. Speaking of Project Arena, I do want to let you guys know that Vantage 2 Update 3 is out. We've added several features into this, which are very, very important, such as layered materials, new multi-math render elements, and we've done some UX changes as well. But layered materials is a big one. That enables a lot more stuff that we can add into Vantage, and definitely go check it out. So if you are interested in Vantage and you want to know more about it, just go ahead and go to chaos.com to learn more about that. And just to let you guys know, a lot of people have said, hey, I want to get in Project Arena. Well, Project Arena is really for stages. So if you have a stage, yes, then we definitely would like to let you guys know about that. But if you just want to know how Vantage works, you can do that. You can just use Vantage, because Vantage is really the essence of what Project Arena is all about. So if you want to take your current projects that are in Max or Maya and you want to see them in real-time ray tracing, you just use Vantage, and that works just as it is. So let me know a little bit about that. Okay, in terms of events, FMX is happening as of the release of this podcast, April 22nd, and it's going through the 25th. I will not, unfortunately, be at FMX this year. I have been very, very busy on this project that I've been mentioning, so I won't be able to go. But we have a lot of stuff going on at FMX, including a lot of talks that we're doing. And so just go ahead and check it out. So just if you are at FMX, we'd love to see you. Just go to chaos.com/events for all other events that are happening as well. Now, of course, if you guys enjoyed a podcast, or this is the first time you're listening to podcast, you can make sure and follow us. All of our podcast pages are at chaos.com/CG Garage. We are also on Facebook, which is facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast. And if you'd like to watch any of these videos, we are all of our videos are at youtube.com/chaosgroupTV, where we post, again, all of our videos, including this podcast. And if you have suggestions of podcasts, please let us know. Just email us labs@chaos.com. We have been getting lots of great suggestions, and we do follow up on a lot of them. So I'd love to hear more if you guys would like to have hear more people on the podcast. Again, that is labs@chaos.com. But for now, please enjoy episode number 470 with Hugo Guerra.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, You need to make sure everything has Fernell.
Awesome having you on. You are, of course, a big personality in the world of visual effects, and you've been doing a lot of this stuff. And I'm sure people might have heard your origin story, but just for the context, you know, this podcast here can be a little broader in terms of its reach with people that are not necessarily in visual effects. Give people a little bit of a background on yourself, like what got you interested in doing visual effects? What's your origin story?
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a delight to be here. It's a pleasure to be invited. I can't thank you enough. Your podcast is fantastic, and congratulations on been running for so long and having so many amazing guests.
Thank you, Hugo.
So I guess I don't want to do a very long story because I think most people already kind of know, but I'm originally from Portugal. My background is art, so I did a fine art degree. That was my original, I was a painter and sculptor and doing video art and doing those kind of things. That was my first thing. And then I kind of like started dabbling into After Effects when I was still at art school to do video art and to do some of my short films.
And what year was this approximately?
This was in 96, yep. When I was in art school. And then I started dabbling with After Effects in 97. So I've been using After Effects since like 97. And now Nuke, of course, for the last 17 years. But that was why I started using these softwares, because I wanted to do my art project, you know. And I did. I found some success. I did a lot of short films, found some success on the award circuit in Portugal. Did a lot of music videos, did a lot of short films, got nominated to a lot of awards there. Even ended up doing like a TV movie as well while I was in Portugal. But I kind of had to like leave Portugal because there was not much of an industry. And so couldn't really find where to go next. And so kind of I left Portugal and became an After Effects artist and then an art director in a company in Sweden.
Which company is that?
I was there for 3 years. It was a company that doesn't really exist anymore. So it was a company at the time in 2004, 5, 6, where I was there for 3 years. This was called Animec at the time. That camera doesn't really exist anymore at that kind of company. And it was mostly a company that used to do, you know, technical videos and corporate videos and commercials, a lot of commercials for the Swedish market. Learned a lot there because I got really into After Effects and Fusion and then Shake and then Nuke while I was at the company. Right. And then I finally came to London, which was always the dream. I had this kind of dream of working at the mill as an artist, and I ended up being able to do that. You know, I went to London, was on set for a couple of projects for the BBC, and then was teaching at Scape Studios, and I was teaching at a couple of universities. Ended up then getting invited, like I ended up like becoming a freelancer at the mill, and then I was there for a few years. Then I became like what we call a permalancer, which is like a freelancer that stays there forever.
You just don't get the benefits of the perma.
No, yeah. I know. And then I ended up being invited to become the head of composting there. And I was the head of composting on Nuke at the company for many years and was on set doing a lot. I had a team of 20-something people on my department, and we did hundreds of commercials while I was at the mill. Kind of left then and left the mill in like 2014, and then became independent. And at that time, I became also a visual effects supervisor, but also a director. So I ended up directing a lot of cinematics for the games industry. Directed cinematics for Ubisoft, directed cinematics for Dumbbusters, directed cinematics for Sony, PlayStation. Ended up working a lot on the video games industry together with an agency called Fire.Smoke, also Sony, PlayStation, and also Fat Shark and Ubisoft and a couple of other companies. And then fast forward to now, I'm still a director. I still direct commercials. I just directed a commercial for Zeiss, and I still supervise on set once in a while. I still comp my own shots, and I have my YouTube channel, which is another life and a
lot of
things.
We'll get to the YouTube channel, but I want to.
Yeah. So that's kind of like how I got there. Yeah. That's the short
story. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Sure. But you were always sort of passionate about the compositing side of things, right? And so you came from the from the final picture guy, right? Like how to make it look good. What was that part of it? Had you have an interest in some of the 3D aspects and all the other CG parts of it, or did you always sort of love that how to make blend reality and CG together?
Yeah. Well, I dabbled mm-hmm. in 3D, dabbled on 3D a bit, and for a while I kind of like did some of it, but I kind of left, you know, you can't really do everything. And yes, it is true. Like, I've always been much more connected to compositing because of my background in arts and also my background in footage, because I used to be a cameraman and I used to take a lot of photos. I used to use cameras all the time. I have a lot of video cameras and I've always used video cameras all the time. And in fact, I even was doing broadcast TV while I was in Portugal for a while. So I kind of like, because I was so connected with cameras and on set and actually shooting something, I think that was why the natural progression to compositing came, because it's all about the footage. And so I kind of gave up on 3D a couple of, like many years, many moons ago, because it's just too much. I just can't do all of it. I prefer to hire better people than me to do it.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. It's a good way to put it. Yeah, yeah. Now, having been cameras, obviously you've seen evolutions in both cameras in terms of how cameras work, digital cameras, and how that affects things. And how have you seen that effect take place with digital compositing and cameras, and how that, you know, because, you know, if you started in 97, you were probably dealing with SD footage at the beginning of things, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. In fact, like if you look at that on the top there, on the top of the shelf there, I have my XL1, Canon XL1 still, and I still have my mini DV cameras, and I have a huge collection of cameras over there. So I still have all my cameras. I started with Video 8, and then I went to II, and then I went to mini DV. So basically went through the revolution of Canon with XL1, XL2, and then basically jumping into HD with Panasonic with 720p. And so, yeah, I got all of that because I was just right on the middle of all of that happening, you know, while we were having still these weird cameras with interlace and HD. And it was just like, it was quite weird at the time. It evolved quite quickly as well. So,
what about color space? The evolution of color space over time?
Yeah, I mean, I guess color space has always been a tricky thing for all the artists, of course. And I was very, obviously, coming from broadcast and from cameras, you know, it was just Rex and Zonine the whole time. There was no any other thing. But once I got to the mill, and because we were trying to synchronize the flame department with the compositing nuke department and also with the color department with Baselite, we had to like have many meetings, and we spent like several years took years to kind of massage a color space pipeline into the entire mill's pipeline all over the world, because they have many offices all over the world. And so we spent a long time, you know, starting to move into linear and then move into actual complete linear workflow, and it took a long time. We never really got all the way to Aces at the time while I was there, because I left before that happened. But I'm now currently using Aces from start to finish in all my projects. And if you really want to like get grasps on Aces between Baselite and DaVinci and Nuke, and you should really like, you know, I really recommend my buddy's Victor Perez's book about Aces. He has a really good book that he just released just recently. It really like goes through the pipeline and how you should set up everything. It's a really, really good book. I really recommend it.
Okay, yeah, well, definitely.
It's not paying me to do that. I'm just
Let's plug his book. It's fine. That's a great idea. In fact, we should probably get him on the podcast. Maybe he can plug it at that point and talk a little bit. Yeah, I love it when we go super deep on geeky stuff sometimes, but not. but that's really cool. Having done all of those things, it was really pretty interesting. Did you always feel that a natural affinity to being on set and to sort of work with people on set? Some people, compositors, are not necessarily always ready to be on set or do those types of things. Is that something that sort of always attracted you to sort of see it happen?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, because, you know, when I was younger, like I couldn't get enough on. I always collected a lot of DVDs and a lot of Blu-rays. Now Blu-rays, of course, but I have thousands. I have almost 2,000 Blu-rays.
I can see
collection.
Them behind you.
And so I'm a huge. I'm a huge nerd. Well, my collection, my Blu-ray collection is downstairs. This is my games collection. That's another thing. but talking about the Blu-rays, because when I was younger, I was obsessed by watching the behind the scenes, you know, because at the time in the 90s and the early 2000s, the Blu-rays were really in detail showing the behind the scenes.
Those
showing
are the DVDs. Like, and the Lord of the Rings one was the big one that had so much stuff.
Amazing. amazing. And David Fincher's DVDs were also really packed to the bone with stuff as well, especially Fight Club's DVD. And there was a lot of really interesting things. And so I got quite obsessed about that. And I learned a lot by watching that. And then I couldn't wait to go on set. And I started going on set when I was still on Sweden in that company at Animec. And then I never looked back. Whenever I had the opportunity, I went on set, both in Sweden, in Portugal, in the mill, also at Sony. I was always on set as much as I could. I also went to LA to do a couple of short films as well. And so it's just amazing because you're there, you're shooting something, a collaborative effort, trying to solve problems. It's such a team effort. I just absolutely love it, trying to troubleshoot both the visual effects, but also even just the normal thing, regular things that has mm-hmm. to be shot. Really recommend anyone that is working on this industry, even if they hate the notion, they should at least go on set once in their career, because it really broadens your mind and opens up how things are done. And it will really give you a different appreciation of how you can solve things, and also kind of in the future, maybe even think in a different way. I'll give you a really sure. quick example. Because I was on set so many times, I got so used to actually getting the entire capture of the entire film. So whenever I had a commercial, I would request the entire rushes, the entire hard drive with all the shots. And just having access to all those shots, because I was on set and I knew what they shot, it was so much easier to find clean plates and to find patches and to find other pieces of other takes that could help with my composting right. work. Because if you just limited yourself to just that one single shot, you kind of like, there might be other shots that might help you stitch something yeah. together. So it really made a huge difference. And also not to mention that you get access to the raw footage, the full resolution footage, which can help you in tracking. It could help you in cleanup. It can help you just to have a more clean plate to work with instead of being dependent on a processed plate from grading or from whoever is feeding or conforming your shots sure. to you, you know?
Sure. So. I actually always, like, when I'm on set, I always, the pressure always is that, you know, especially the time that you have, right? When the AD gives you saying, okay, you know, you have 5 minutes to make a decision that's going to affect months of work, you know? And you're like, yeah, because something changes. Like, well, we're going to do it this way now. Is that going to work for you? Wait, oh, what? And you don't have a choice, you know? It's like, you have to sort of make these choices, and they're very tough choices. You don't have, like, well, let's sit down and talk about it. No, you don't have that kind of time, right?
No. Don't you feel that you become such a better artist because of that? Because I felt like the troubleshooting part is always, I teach a lot, as you know, and I always notice my students really have a problem with troubleshooting because they're not used to going and making decisions in a quick pace. And just being on set just makes your mindset in a different way. You start killing your darlings really quickly, and you start really just caring about the absolute essential. Mm-hmm. And I think that really makes a huge difference. Even when you're working normally in production at your studio or at your home, it just makes a different type of rhythm to work. You know, I just felt I can't tell people enough to try to be on set. And it's actually easier than you think, because whenever you go to a big company, you know, it's always quite simple for you to kind of reach out to the VFX supervisor that is on the company. There's always a couple of people on the company that always mm-hmm. go on set, and you can just reach out to them and say, can you bring me along next time and I can assist you or help you? And I'm sure they're going to say yes, because they need help.
Yeah, I was like, oh, please, thank you. Yes.
Exactly. And then you're going to learn so much. You know, like I always try to bring my juniors whenever I can with me on set.
And it's always a great experience to do that, for sure. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk a little bit. You know, I talked about juniors. Let's talk about your passion for education and for teaching people this. What started that, and how did that sort of get going for you?
It's hard to pinpoint when it started because I don't really actually remember when it kind of came up. Like my channel is going to be 9 years this year, and so I started my channel while I was still at the mill. And while I was at the mill, because so many flame artists really wanted to know Nuke, I started doing these weekly workshop mornings. You know, like anyone could join in. You know, I had a suite for my clients' reviews, and inside my suite, you know, people would just sit down and they would just like we would go through Nuke and I would teach sections of Nuke. And I think it was a bit of that, of teaching flame artists how to transition to Nuke. And also I was then invited to work to teach at a university in Sweden called Campus I-12, which also unfortunately doesn't exist anymore. And I was invited to go there and also teach. And I think I was very lucky, you know. I was super lucky, Chris, because I was the few people that started using Nuke right away.
So I was going to say, because you did it, you said around 2003. Yeah. I mean, that was when Nuke became a product.
Exactly. So I started using Nuke. I was very lucky in the Swedish company that I was with. They bought Nuke from D2, not Foundry. They bought Nuke in 2005. And I started testing Nuke before that with the demo, and then I started using it in production in 2005. Mm-hmm. And so it's been like 17 to 18 years now that I've been using it. And then of course they got bought in 2017 by Foundry. And so I was quite lucky, Chris, because I everyone was using Shake in London. Like Shake was all over the place. Everyone just used Shake. Exactly. And Shake was always there, and Flame as well, especially in London. And I was the few people that actually had years of experience using Nuke. No one even knew how to use Nuke. And that is why schools would invite me to do workshops, and then Escape Studios invited me to take over their course as well. Because I think I was the few, except people from D2, of course, from Digital Domain, I was the few people that was outside that actually used it in production. And so I was very lucky. I think I was really, really lucky there. And that's why I got invited so much to teach. But I, going back to your question, I do love to teach. Like I feel like it's a responsibility for a senior like me.
Well, you know, I've been working off of 20. Who was your mentor?
Well, my mentors were from the art school. You know, I had many mentors. You know, I have a lovely teacher, which is, I'm sure he's not listening, but a teacher called Gonzalo and a teacher called Carlos Gonzalez. And they were really my mentors when I was there. And they taught me all about art and all about composition and photography and how to do pretty pictures, you know, I would say. And because they were so open with it and they were artists themselves, and I would also like get so much along with them, I kind of like, I think that's where it started to come, you know. And then when I worked in productions in big studios, I kind of felt a bit weirded out by the fact that some artists didn't want to teach what they knew because they were afraid of teaching their things.
Their secret sauce.
Exactly. Especially when you meet flame artists, they do that a lot. And I feel like it's my responsibility to evolve the industry. And so as a senior, I feel a responsibility to teach as many people as I can. Because I didn't have that opportunity when I was younger, because there was no visual effects teaching. I had to go to art school. And so I feel like a big responsibility, not only to evolve the industry, but also because these will be the artists that I will work with in the future. And so I want them to be good as well. And I want them to know. And I want to pass along as much information as I can. I really feel like a big, big passion by teaching people and showing people things. And I because I'm so passionate about it, you know, I like really can't shut up about it.
Well, let's talk about you not shutting up about it, because I'm very passionate about, like, interesting about starting a YouTube and how that did it. So, I mean, you mentioned you were doing your stuff at the mill, right? And you were teaching people in person and in your suite. How did you transition that to a YouTube channel? When did you said 9 years ago. So YouTube channels, especially on this subject, were not as big as they are now.
Oh, no. I'm the first. I'm definitely the first Nuke work YouTube channel. Like I know for a fact, because at the time there was nothing. And I'm still probably, I'm still the biggest Nuke independent channel in the world. Of course, if I count with Foundry, they're bigger than me, but not by much. Like they're just a little bit bigger than me. Exactly. So as an independent, I'm the biggest one by far for compositing in Nuke. And I've just reached close to 60,000 subscribers now, which is tiny for YouTube.
For Nuke, that's industry, all the compositors.
Exactly. And when I started, it was quite rapid. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like a lot of people suggesting, oh, you should open a YouTube channel. Oh, you should open it. Everyone kept saying that. And I was already watching YouTube for other things because I'm a huge gamer. So I was watching YouTube because of games. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to give this a go. And I started and I got really a lot of success. I got like in the first 3 months, I already had 2,000 subscribers. And then my curve was really going fast and it's still going fast. I have like about 1,000 subscribers per month. Around 1,000 subscribers per month. And so I'm going to reach 100,000 probably in like about 2 years or something like that. And so I'm really, really happy with that. And obviously my channel these days is not just composting. I also have the podcast with Ian Files,
which we're going to talk about.
So that's also a big part of my channel these days, because we started that 3 years ago. But I still, of course, very passionate about having a lot of composting there. And it's been great. You know, I've managed to get a really nice community there. We have a lot of we do a lot of live streams, and it's always really so cool to see so many known people that go to my stream and say hello. And it's a really nice community. Everyone is so nice to each other. And I'm very happy to say as well that I've been told by many YouTubers now that they were inspired by my channel to open their own channels as well. And so I'm so happy that that is now happening. And now, of course, there's thousands of YouTube channels that relate to this kind of topics. But I am so happy that it kind of like went to YouTube.
What do you have to do? What do you have to do to get more? Or in terms of, because obviously creating the content is something that the back of your hand, you know exactly what it's going to look like, you know what it's going to do, you know what you're going to show. But how do you manage the YouTube-ness part, the getting the people there, make sure the schedule's on? Like, what are the things that your people need to know if they're going to start their own thing? What's the secret there, especially in our industry?
Well, the first thing I will say is that on our industry, it is incredibly difficult to ever get any kind of good revenue on YouTube. Yeah. And so if you're going to do it because of the money, I would advise you not to even start, because it's not about that at all. You'll never get a lot of money from YouTube, because YouTube's algorithm really doesn't work for a small channel. And believe me when I say that I've had many meetings with YouTube, you know, because I'm a beta tester for YouTube, and I have a lot of meetings with the development team at YouTube, and it's incredibly difficult for the algorithm to really catch a niche product like my channel. And so I really advise people to not be dissuaded by the lack of revenue that they're going to get from YouTube, because it's going to be dollars, not thousands. It's going to be like it's going to be counted in two digits, maybe three if you're lucky. So, you know, you're probably going to like find yourself to $50 a month, or maybe $100 a month, and then $200 a month, and then that's going to be a good month. And so don't focus on that. I think people should focus on the way of building a community and a following, and then that will drive a way for you to maybe sell a book or sell a course or sell a workshop or sell other things that you might have, or even sell yourself. I must say that it's funny how things turned out because of my YouTube videos of deconstructions, and because I show a lot of production. I always ask my clients if I can show the real shots, and I do show real productions on my channel, because I always bother my clients until they say yes. And so because of that, I've had also new clients that contacted me to do jobs because of my channel.
Oh, they saw how you did something.
So in fact, like I years ago, like I was contacted by many game studios to do cinematics because of my channel. Zeiss was the same thing. They also contacted me because of the content that I do on my channel. And so it's like I said, the channel is like a gateway to something else that you might be doing, either a workshop, a course, or a book, or even just like an online course or a platform. Or even, you know, if you're doing more techie thing, it could even be a gateway to sell equipment or to sell other things. I think that's the approach. And of course, with that, it's all about microtransactions. So then you can have that, and then you can have a Patreon as well, and you can have other things on the top of that to try to help you. And of course, then if you have a podcast, you can have some sponsors as well, and it kind of grows that way. It doesn't really, unless you can reach 1 million views, you're never really going to see real money from YouTube. Right. You know, it's not enough to at least to get paid enough as you get on the industry.
I mean, obviously, we've seen, you know, you got to do it for the passion, right? I agree for that. Absolutely. You exactly. know, and I've been doing this podcast for almost 10 years, right? So, and this was like something I was like, well, you know, I just know people that's going to be fun hanging out with, like, just as fun, right? So I get to do that, and it's a lot of fun to sort of to think about that, or just think about what that passion is. But there is now obviously a lot of traction in this interest that's going on. Obviously, companies like the Corridor Crew, I mean, they are very, very popular, and they don't make movies. In fact, they have no actual practical experience.
No.
But they have an entire channel that is very popular, showing people how to do this stuff, right?
Yeah, they do, but that's not really the same. Like, they do get revenue, and they do get they can live from the content on YouTube. But Corridor Digital, you know, I know them, and they are really nice to me, and I feel like they are cool, but they are nothing more than a marketing channel for visual effects. They don't really go deep into things at all, and in fact, I have discussed this online many times on my podcast, and also even online on Twitter. I do think that they actually didn't help the situation, because a lot of times their bluntless disrespect sometimes to visual effects and the way that they sometimes phrase or name things on their channels by a clickbait way, sometimes it's not good for the industry, because it's not just their fault, but I definitely think they have contributed to the no CGI and the backlash that exists right now. I definitely think they've contributed to that backlash because of their videos called bad CGI and React, and that really contributed to that. And now, recently, you've started noticing that the studios are not even using Corridor Digital to promote their film, especially for the Oscars and for the award season. So Corridor Digital has become a marketing platform, really, for the big films, just like you just saw recently with The Creator. Like, they had Gareth Edwards there, they talked in detail about all the shots, and that was really the week before the Oscars, just to try to push that and try to get nominated, to try to win the Oscar. And so I feel like they had good intentions, but I do think that sometimes it goes a bit, it's not really the same. Like, I do tutorials and I do training and I do things like that. And of course, I have a podcast with a lot of opinions, but I work in the industry. You know, I work in this industry and I work in it, and they don't. And so it's just, I always advise everyone to never really judge anyone that has done anything. And I always try my best to not judge a film or a bad CG shot or whatever, because I wasn't there. And if I wasn't there, I don't know what happened. You never know what happened with the client, what happened with the feedback and the producer, or even the budget, or even the pressures they had. Or no one knows until, like, if you don't know that information, you can't be on your high chair saying, that's bad. Well, they try their best, I'm sure.
Did you know, see, like, Jonas Huesing's videos that he's done on no CGI?
Yeah, of course.
They're so
good. Yeah, of course I did. They're really, really good. Yes. Yeah, of course. Absolutely. I've been banging on that drum for 3 years on my podcast.
And so have I. I just say it was just nice to see the context with which he put it. And it was like, so well put together.
It's brilliant. Yes. They're really, really good. And I've talked many times with him. He's such a nice guy. And he's going to be at FMX as well, presenting a panel.
I heard, which is so exciting. Nice. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm going to get to meet him in person as well, because I'm going to be at FMX as well doing a panel. So I'm at FMX doing a VFX Notes podcast live with Ian as well. And so I'm going to get to meet him in person. But yeah, these videos are fantastic, and they are just the perfect mix of something that could be shown to a person outside the industry, which is nice. And the way he's explaining it is really easy and really, like, you know, I could show it to friends of mine that don't work in this industry, and they'll probably understand it, which is exactly what you need.
Absolutely. That's really good. I think, well, first of all, this is a great advice on people and thinking about what we need to do and think about how this is working. It's just kind of fascinating now that people are, you know, YouTube itself, has become so much more, and the production values that people are doing for YouTube are going so high that it's going beyond I'm making a movie, a TV show. It's like, no, I want to see a really amazing YouTube, and there's some great stuff. What are your thoughts about that? Like, just the media itself, how media is changing, and how visual effects, especially 2D, because 2D is used in almost everything, right? How you think about the media itself and the trends that are happening there? Well, YouTube, just like everything. Like, I mean, like, YouTube and, you know, TikTok even, vertical videos now, like everything. Like, think about that.
Yeah, things changed quite rapidly, really, to be honest. Because when I started on YouTube, YouTube was not taken seriously at all. And now it's taken as serious as any other TV channel. And in fact, it's probably getting a lot more traction than
way
any
more,
TV channel.
Way more.
Yeah, way more. And so, because the advent of, people, there are many people that I know that only watch YouTube. They don't watch anything else. They don't even watch TV, which, you know, it has its benefit and its downfalls as well, of course. It would be nice if people leave their bubbles, because YouTube feeds you an algorithm. And I kind of like feel that I do miss the discoverability of things that you just stumbled upon by just watching TV, because sometimes you're just swapping channels and you would find something randomly. And so, like you would do when you go to a record shop or to a Blu-ray shop or anything like that. And so that's gone, of course, unfortunately. And now it's all algorithmically fed. But it is amazing to see the production level. And you've mentioned Corridor Digital. Corridor Digital are an example of that. They do an amazing visual effects on their productions, and their standards are as high as any BBC TV program that I've ever seen. And in fact, I think it's even better than a BBC program that I've seen. And he's not alone. You know, like, there's a lot of content creators on YouTube that are doing remarkable work, even using composting and even using CG on their work. So I guess that's a brand new platform and a brand new marketplace for artists like us, you know, which is really cool as well. But it has changed so rapidly. Yeah,
for sure. For sure. Okay, so you mentioned, I'm going to get some more difficult questions, if that's okay.
That's fine.
You mentioned, obviously, that the backlash that people had with no VFX, you know, or no CGI. That's a conversation that we've had a lot of, obviously. And, you know, as a personality, as someone that's out there that's talking about stuff, right now we have a huge amount of conversation happening around the use of new tools, especially AI tools, and how that affects things. How do you navigate those waters? How do you talk about those things, good or bad, without necessarily being villainized by one camp or another?
Well, I know what you mean. I do think that there is a lot of noise, a lot of hype, and a lot of this is just going to, you know, the dust is going to settle and there will be other things that will happen. I'm a huge supporter of machine learning tools, which I use in Nuke and I use in a lot of softwares as well. And I do think that tools that can help the artistic endeavor and tools that can help the way we work are really welcome, and, you know, to try to evolve the industry and to try to make it faster and more comfortable for all of us. But I can't agree with some of the tools that are out there, which are blatantly using art from other people and really using, you know, should be copyright striked by that. But I feel like there is right now, unfortunately, the hype is so strong that everything gets pulled into the same bag, you know, AI. AI is this buzzword and everything is inside this buzzword. But there are different levels of AI and there's different things that are happening right now in the industry. I think once the hype settles, and I never really believe anyone that when they show things, and even recently, a couple of months ago, there was this huge hype about the Wonder Studio thing, about doing 3D, and I did a live stream about it, and I opened the software, used my own plates on it, and nothing worked. I was like, okay, this doesn't even work. It does. I've tried eight complete different shots, and none of it worked. And then I was, of course, attacked on the comments. Oh, I didn't do it correctly. You need to do it this way. You need to do it that way. And I'm like, guys, you don't get to say how the shot is done. Like, you get the shot and you need to do it. You know, no one controls that. So I think there's a lot of hype and there's a lot of AI bros on Twitter and on social media trying to push this idea that it's going to replace everything. I don't believe that's going to happen. I feel like it's going to become another tool in our arsenal. And in fact, I think that it's going to settle down and it's going to just become another tool that we're going to use on our disposal. I have that feeling. And I guess I'm a little bit more positive than most people about it, because I don't really believe that hype because I've tested it so many times and it never really works. And so I'm kind of like thinking maybe it will get there some point, but I'm not so sure it will be that easy for these companies to get away with what they're trying to do. I'm not that sure, because if you think about it, if you really start thinking about it, so many creators and so many directors work right now. There's never been as many directors as we have right now, probably, you know, like doing film.
Or YouTube.
And so do you really, yeah, or YouTube. Do you really think that they're all going to like stop shooting things outside with a camera? Do you really think that they're going to stay at home and prompt their entire film? I really don't believe that, because people love to gather. People love to work as a team. People love to work as a community. They love going somewhere to shoot and film and find happy accidents when they're filming. I just don't really believe that we're going to... I mean, I think some parts in the industry might be replaced.
Corporate videos.
You know, I'm sure that it's going to... Corporate videos, and I'm sure stock footage will be changed forever by it. And people trying to get a quick buck. Yeah, of course, we've always had those. You know, that's sure. Fine. And we also had hacks and people that want to do things and don't have any talent whatsoever. That's fine. That's always existed. It's just that they're now more multiplied by the social media. But I think when the dust settles, the artists are the artists, and they're still going to create and they're going to find ways. And in fact, I even think that there will be some artists that will be that will actually make a point of saying this project was done without AI. This is a project we done manually. Just like
this is no CG.
You know, exactly. Well, that also happens. But I feel like art is art, and we, you know, people still paint, people still sculpt, people still do crafts, sure. And people still do. I just really think people shouldn't be that scared. It's going to impact, of course. It's going to impact it, of course, but people need to then adapt to that. You know, that's the thing. Like you, because it's not going to go away. You can't really stop it.
Right.
You can't stop it. So if you can't stop it, you need to adapt to it, and you need to kind of use it as well and use it into... but I do think it's too early. I think it's too early. I'm not really even sure exactly what tools will succeed, because there's so many right now. And... it's going to take a while until one, two, or three of them will succeed.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, there's this technology. I hate to, you know, people are going to come down on me on this, but it's like technology has always disrupted things. Always. Right?
Yeah, of course.
And I'm going to say it's like, CG. No, I'm going way, way, way back. Like, I'll use an example that's concrete. And you'll see why that's ironic. Architecture. Right? There used to be this thing where if you're using metal for structure in architecture, that's not architecture. That's engineering. That's a big thing. It's like, Eiffel, he's not an architect. He's an engineer. That's not real architecture, right? Architecture follows these rules. And so obviously that's changed now. A lot of architecture uses metal. So we can definitely put that aside. But, you know, and that those disruptions of how engineering's changed and how all things change has constantly evolved, right? And you've got people now who are using digital content that were called, you're not an architect or you're not an artist because you use Photoshop. Those guys are complaining. It's like, you're not an artist because you use AI, right? Now.
Exactly.
So I always think it's very interesting to think about that. Now, in terms of you did mention... people's works being used by AI tools, right? Here's my thoughts on it. I do not believe in a court of public opinion, and I think that is one of the most destructive things that's happened to our society for everything. Like, all politics now are courts of public opinion, not real courts, right? So, I believe there's definitely merit to explore these subjects. There's very strong merit to explore these subjects, but I'm not going to form an opinion on whether there is an actual copyright infringement until an actual court decides these things.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And that's why I'm saying that I'm waiting. That's why I want the dust to settle, because I don't even know what's exactly happening. It's none of it is being used. It's not even legal to use it in a production right now, at least in Europe, in the UK. So you can't
even... The companies are afraid to use it because there might be legal ramifications. Yes.
Exactly. But also, what I meant to say is that you can't copyright it. That's the thing.
Oh,
so if you can't copyright it, it's a bit useless for a company, because they can't earn any money from it because it's open. So... It's yeah, I completely agree with you. Like, the hype is way too big, and all these people giving opinions on social media, they know nothing about mm-hmm. what's going on. I really strongly believe that at some point, this is all going to settle, and we're going to finally understand what happened, which softwares are going to be the ones. And I am sure that they also have legal teams that don't want to be sued.
Yep.
So it's a bit like, I am sure that they are also looking into those things. It's really funny that you talk about the Eiffel Tower, because it was hated when it came out.
Oh, yeah, it was
out.
Horrible. People thought it was an eyesore.
People wanted to bring it down.
It was only supposed to be up for 100 years and then come down.
I know. And now Paris is still the world's most visited city in the world because of that thing, not because of anything else. And so I'll even go in and even as far as another example that people often forget. When photography occurred and happened for the first time and
destroyed
also
destroyed portraits.
Like, I'm not talking about exactly, but what happened? If we didn't have photography, we didn't have abstract painting. Yeah. And if we didn't have photography, we didn't have impressionism. We didn't have all those cubism, impressionism, abstract painting, modern painting, pop art. All those things did not exist if we didn't have photography. So think about the amazing things that will happen once AI mm-hmm. settles. The new forms of art and the new forms of creative processes that we're going to have because of artists fighting back with something brand new. I can't wait to see that. And I just say, that's why I'm saying that I'm maybe slightly more positive than most people, because I, coming from an art school, I have a degree in arts, you know, I know what happened.
And you know what you're doing, what you're saying,
that.
Hugo, is that you are differentiating art and craft. You know the difference between art and craft, and you're talking about art.
Exactly.
And everyone else is complaining that their craft is dying, not that their art is dying.
It's very different.
It's a huge difference.
Very different. Yeah. Yeah, and I know that not everyone has the ability to have an art degree, but people should really like try to understand art a bit better, and maybe try to also, not only that, but also people are obsessed with also hardware, software, and things. People need to be more agnostic. Yes. Come on, like people need to be more agnostic. It's all about the artistry of it and the core skills. It's not about the software. It's not about the app. It's not about whatever they come up with. It's not about the camera. People really confuse technology, creativity, and art, and all. It's all in the same bag. And it's not only dangerous to the industry, but also like it's a mess. Oh man, you go to Twitter. Every other tweet is about this. And I'm like, I've started muting words on Twitter now because I can't stand it anymore. Like, it's just so boring and so disruptive.
I just want to say one final thing about the whole legal thing is I want people to know that there is work being done to solve this problem about copyright. And Carla Ortiz is leading a lot of that work right now. And I really admire what she's doing, because if she wasn't doing actually something as opposed to bitching about it on Twitter, right? She's actually doing something about it. And there's several of them, but she's the person that I know and I admire. And she's actually doing it. And I'm very happy that she is, because that's going to sort of solve the unquestionable thing that we can move on from. And I think that's really, really great. But in terms of...
Yeah. It might even solve the problem. It might even turn out that you even get royalties from it, which is even better. So I feel like there's so many opportunities here to happen, and I really recommend people to just calm down, just calm down a little bit, especially because it's not going to replace anything right now. Like, we still need work. Because
people
have
to trust the fact that their skill is how good their eye is, not how much they know how to move a slider.
I have thousands of students on my online course, and I get messages almost every day of people saying, shouldn't have bought the course. I think it's too late now to be a compositor. And I always like answer them, what are you talking about? There are thousands of films to be done. You can probably still be working for 10 years now. Like, come on, just go for it. Earn your money now. Work now. Learn your skill now. Go for it. There's so much work. There's so much lack of artists to do this work. Like, companies struggle to find people to do things. They struggle to find high quality artists that know and have a good eye, like you just said. Like, they're not after click makers. They're not after people that know where to click on all the softwares. They're looking for people that know how to do an image, how to make something that looks good. Doesn't matter how you made it.
I think what's really funny is that, you know, people's like, ah, AI art is terrible. It's like, AI art's not terrible. It's someone who made it is terrible. Right? There's been terrible art for years. You just go to any motel in America and look at whatever is hanging over your head, and you'll see that terrible art has existed all over the world for so long. And
some of them are so bad that they look good, actually.
Yeah, yeah. So yes, what I think is interesting, though, is what the hell is going on in people's heads? To me, that's fascinating because it's so easy to prompt and get an image, right? To say, I want to see a picture of, you know, Kim Kardashian as a unicorn eating a popsicle. I was like, why would that be in your head, you know? And
why would you want to do that?
Because
and what are you going to do with it? What are you going
to
do with it?
Before this, when you used to go to popular places like ArtStation or whatever, all you saw was an Iron Man suit and a girl in a bikini with a sword, right? And so that's all you saw. Now suddenly there's so much more weird stuff that is coming out because it's in people's heads. Now, I'm not necessarily saying it's the right tool to use it or it's copyright or like do it in the style of whatever. Like all of those things are definitely questions that we need to be aware of, but it's just it's like, what is going on in people's heads? This is awesome just to think about, you know, average Joe actually has something he wants to see, which is cool.
I know. People are much more weirder than you think, which is quite fascinating as well to see it, because we didn't see these kind of things. We used to like see it only on our own local school or local pub or local restaurant. And there was like always like these weird comments here and there. But now we're seeing them in the public domain. It's fascinating. I didn't even thought about that. Like, it is a great way. Someone needs to do a study about this, about the psyche of all these people and see like what's happening. I'm sure people are already doing that.
It's a great little slice of like, here's the culture of 2024 and understanding what people are excited about. So let's talk a little bit about your podcast and how you hooked up with Ian and how all that started. Tell us a little bit about that and what's it all about? Because some people may not necessarily know your podcast, so this is a good opportunity for them to learn about it and subscribe to it.
Of course. Well, thank you so much for plugging the podcast. I am so grateful for you to do that. Yeah, so the podcast, you know, it's called VFX Notes, and it's a podcast that we now do every week. And we basically, you know, me and Ian just sit down and review films. We just go through, we usually always start by reviewing the film. Normally, there are films with a lot of visual effects, sometimes not a lot, but sometimes there's always some component of VFX. That's why it's called VFX Notes Podcast. And we review the film. We always talk a lot about the cinematography because that's a big passion of mine. And also we all talk about a lot about the visual effects, of course, because it's also a passion of both Ian and me. And then at the end, we also always have a lot of topics and other topics that are discussed around the film and around how it's made. And the differentiation thing about this podcast and others' podcasts probably could be that we do the podcast as a video podcast, although you can hear it as an audio podcast, of course, as well. But the video component of it is very different from the podcast because while we're talking, I go through the trouble of edit in all the behind the scenes, the official behind the scenes I can find, all the official breakdowns I can find. And while we're talking, you actually get to see everything that we're talking about. And so, and this, of course, takes me days to do the videos and the podcast, but that's okay. That's fine. That is the different. It's a lot of work. It's definitely.
Especially in a weekly, I'm now editing. How long are these podcasts? How long is each episode?
They're usually an hour to an hour and a half. So yes, I'm doing weekly. I'm doing a motion picture. Yes, that's what I'm doing because I'm editing it in HD and DaVinci, and I'm like gathering all the. Well, basically, Ian has a lot of footage and a lot of B-roll he gets from the studios from his articles, and then I also gather stuff from the official websites of the studios, and then we collect it all on this podcast. But you can still listen to it as an audio podcast if you use the YouTube music app. You can still listen with it locked and only listen to us, but so that's kind of the different thing about the podcast, because we have a lot of visual component, because, you know, it's visual effects. I thought it has to have visuals, you know. So but going back to your question about how it happened, it's quite funny because I was invited, this happened 3 years ago. So I was invited, Ian invited me to go to his podcast. At the time he had a podcast, which I don't remember the name. He had several names and now it's only called Before and After. But he invited me to talk about the first film that used Nuke, which was Interview with Vampire. They used Nuke on prompt command line. So I went into the podcast. We talked about Nuke. We talked about how it was. And we talked about Interview with the Vampire. And so we had a lot of fun, the two of us, doing that episode for his podcast. And at the very end of the podcast, I just turned to him and said, this was so much fun, man. It's been years since I've talked with you so long, because we've been friends for many years. And so, oh yeah, this was great as well, wasn't it? And say, yeah, we should do a podcast. And Ian was like, yeah, that's great. So what are you doing Thursday? And that was it. That was it. Like, he just turned to me and said, are you free Thursday? Yeah, I'm free Thursday. And then we did episode one. And then we now have 60 episodes.
But you are in London and he is in Sydney. So how does that work in terms of your time zones?
Yeah, so we bounce around between the times. We have two slots. We either do it at my 9 o'clock in the morning, which is like 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock in the evening,
almost
depending
12
on the time
hours
zone.
Apart, exactly, right?
Exactly. So we either do it me at 9 and his at 9 in the evening, or I do it, I'm a night owl, so I really like to work at night. Ever since I've been working remotely and from my house for 8 years now, and so I work at night. And so a lot of lately we've been doing it at 2 o'clock in the morning, and that's like 12 o'clock for him. So that's my preferred slot, because I am very, very much articulated at 2 o'clock in the morning, and he's still on his afternoon, so it's much better for him and for me. So yeah, it's normally it would have been a bad schedule for most people, but for me, since I'm an idol, I'm happy with that.
Okay. And you still, besides that, you are still doing your other YouTube, right, as well?
Yeah. So I do streams every week as well. So I do it Thursdays.
And these are live streams?
On Thursdays. Yeah, live streams. I do it on Thursdays at 3 o'clock in the afternoon UK time. So I alternate between showreel reviews, where I review showreels from people. They're called, the series is called Honest Showreel Reviews, where people, I don't review their showreel without the presence of the artist. So the person has to be there with a microphone and a webcam, and we talk through the showreel. And it's a very, although the name sounds Honest Showreel Reviews, it's a highly constructive feedback loop that I construct reviewing the showreel, just like I used to do when I was at the mill or at Sony or at any other company, interviewing people. It's like an interview. You know, I'm interviewing the person and going through the shots. And I do like two or three artists per week. And I do it every other week. And then the other stream I do is Nuke Composting, where I deconstruct production shots that I've done over the years. Always real shots. They're not tutorials. I open the real shot that I did with the client, and I go through how we did it. I show versions. I show versions I sent to the client. I show the evolution of the shot. I show concept art, and I go through the entire shots of either a cinematic, a commercial, or a short film, depending on what I'm doing that week. So yeah, every week on Hugo's desk, and I alternate between showreels and Nuke Disconstructions. I do that every week as well. And then occasionally I also have a review video, either of a tech review video, either a monitor review or a Blackmagic camera review or whatever things that I'm reviewing at the time.
And you did one obviously on the Wonder Studios.
Yes, I did, yeah. And I do it very, very subtly now, but my passion is video games, and so I haven't done it in a long time, but I used to do reviews on games as well, the games that I really love, and I'm going to go back to that. But it's busy. I'm really busy with my production work and my own work. You know, I'm composting a TV show for Amazon right now, and with my team, and I've just finished the commercial. So I'm also busy with my own work.
So you actually have a job on top of all of this stuff.
Yeah. YouTube is my part time. YouTube is like just my main job is a VFX supervisor and working as composer and also as a director. But I don't take all the this is something else that I didn't mention. When I was at the mill, we used to do a lot of work, you know, because they would take anything. I don't really do that on my company. I have my own company, and I only do one job at a time. I never do more than one job at a time. I just learned the hard way, because I was burned out by so much work that I now just do one job. I have a job, I do that job, and then when I finish, I get another job. And that's it. Like, I do one commercial at a time, one TV show at a time, one short film at a time. I never take in two, three, four jobs at the same time, because I just don't want to be there again. I don't want to burn out, and I don't want to be incredibly tired. And I also want to keep teaching my students, and I want to keep doing streams. And, you know, I have an online course, which I have over 2,000 students on that course, and I do classes for them, and we do meetings, and I have a Discord channel with them, and I talked with them every day, you know. So I like doing those things. I don't want to just work, you know. I want to do other things as well. So,
well, that's amazing. That's a lot of stuff. I know, you know, when I started this podcast, my feeling was like, okay, how am I going to do this? And I told myself, minimum, like, don't edit. You know, this is going to be an honest conversation between people, and therefore I don't have to edit them. And I figured that's one of the things that I learned to do, is so that I don't have to do a huge amount, because I'm doing similar things. I'm writing blog posts, I'm doing things, course, and like, you know, it's really hard to juggle everything. So,
I know. I'm making my life more difficult by putting breakdowns in behind the scenes. Yeah. I know. And Ian is always telling me, like, don't do that. Just put the podcast. I'm like, no, Ian, I need to put the breakdowns.
Hey, man,
come on.
If that's it, if that's what you want, I would do it. Do it. Yeah, that's good.
I just wanted to, like, also mention really quickly, if you would allow me, I also want to plug something else that I also do in the side as well. So my wife, Anna, she is an excellent cook, and she has a YouTube channel as well. She has a cooking channel called Green Recipes for All. And I just helped her to do a book, and she now has published a book as well, called also Green Recipes for All. So I did also that. So we worked on that for almost 2 years. So that was a really fun side project that I've never done in my life. I've never done a book. We did all the photos together. We did all the processing the photos. I never used InDesign before in my life. I now used it for the first time. Doing a book is hard.
Yeah.
I was like quite amazed
by
that.
Turns out they have a lot of pages.
But it's so cool. I really enjoy doing books. So I really want to do a book of my own as well, regarding VFX. Now that I've done the book with Anna, with my wife, and I love that as well. I love to do a lot of things, Chris. That's the thing. I've always enjoyed that. And I know most people know me for compositing, because for some reason I became famous for that, but I do a lot of things. I film, I do photography, I do compositing, I do a lot of things. So I like that. I like that discovery of doing different things almost every day. I do enjoy that.
Well, it
very
certainly
much,
sounds,
you know,
like you're not bored.
No, I'm not.
You're not. No, there's nothing sort of monotonous about your days. Every day is going to be something exciting.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, listen, Hugo, this has been amazing having you on. I would, you know, when things come up, I'm going to reach out to you again and say, okay, Hugo, you got to come on. We got to talk about this, you know, whatever. So I'm going to reach out to you again, I'm sure, in the future. But it's amazing. This is the first time that you've been on the podcast. It's been a long time coming. So thank you so much for doing it, man.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. No, it was my pleasure, and it was amazing to talk to you, Chris. And also, like, congratulations on the podcast. Your podcast is amazing. It's by far one of the best podcasts of the industry.
Oh,
and
thank you.
The guests you get in, they are mind blowing. And I was so humbled by that. I was looking at your guest lists of the last few months, and I was like, he wants me on the podcast? Why?
Like, well, for obvious reasons, Hugo. For obvious reasons. It's very, you're very important, and you stand out in the industry. And I think you're a very important voice that is bringing up a lot of great stuff. And I think people listen to you for a good reason. And I think it'd be good for us to, you know, make people know that you're aware
there's
a lot of resources that people can go to, especially you as a resource. So thank you so much for doing the things that you do.